Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today from Central Ohio is our consumer editor, Jeremy Korsnewski. What's going on, man?
Well, I'm currently sitting outside. It is officially fall. We're recording this on a Tuesday at the end of September, and it is overcast. There's a little bit of a chill in the air, but it's just nice enough that I can still sit outside, so I'm making use of that.
About roughly 100 or so miles to the north is where I sit, and the weather is almost exactly the same. Maybe not even 100, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it's fall, good time of year, one of my favorites. It's been a little cooler, actually. You know, we had a relatively cool September, and then it did kind of heat up at the end, but I mean, it's October now. You know, it's going to be October, and by the time anybody's listening to this, it will definitely be October. So.
Yeah, and I mean, not that anyone really needs to know this, but I will turn 40 years old on October 9th, so quite the...
Congratulations.
I guess 40 years is a congratulatory event, right? Big round number.
That's a big one, but, mm-hmm. You know, at the same time, you know, the cliche age is just a number, and that's
40
awesome.
Is the new what?
30?
40 is a new 30, yeah.
Let's roughly.
Let's go it.
Yep. Something like that. Anyways, happy birthday early to Jeremy, and we got a great show for you. We could all celebrate here. We're going to talk a lot about the cars Jeremy has been driving. The Crosstrek, he went to a first drive of that, actually in Ohio. We're going to get down into the X1 versus the X2 versus the Countryman. Just a little bit of sort of... I don't know. We'll break down which of these platform mates we like the best. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. I know you've spent some time in some of them anyway. Mm-hmm. All of them,
yep.
Right?
I've driven all of them, yeah. The most recently, the X1, but I've been in a couple variants of X2. I think I've been in all the Countrymans, including the plug-ins. I have thoughts.
Cool. Sounds good. I have thoughts as well. And... Good. Then, lastly, we will circle on back and talk about the Cadillac CT5, which we did talk about recently with West Coast editor James Ryswick, but Jeremy has spent some time in it. It'll be good to see if these thoughts kind of line up. And I always find Cadillac to be a bit of a lightning rod. It's great to talk about it. People are interested in it. So, we'll talk about it again. Got a new segment here talking about what's going on with a plan to have basically electric cars in California by 2035. That's going to be interesting. We'll see if it comes to pass. Look at our crystal balls and a couple other green things. And that's the show. Coming up in a few weeks while I have Jeremy here, I'll tease it out to everybody else. We haven't set a date for it, but we will do like a fall beer podcast. Mm-hmm. We did a summer beer podcast where we just talked about all sorts of different brands and things we like. But this one, it's October. I think it's a great time to do one specifically revolving around like all the great fall beers you could get, especially in the upper Midwest. I think we're especially good at these types of beers that are, you know, robust, flavorful, have their own sort of take. But that'll be coming up in, say, a couple of weeks.
Well, I think we've got such great fall beers because we've got such great falls.
It's true.
Like, having lived all over the country, you know, I lived in Arizona for years. I lived in the Pacific Northwest. And, nothing is quite like fall in the Midwest. Like, it gets crisp. The colors start changing. We have better colors here than any place I've ever lived. East Coast, you know, Rhode Island, those areas, they've got pretty colors there, too. But just something about fall in the Midwest and football season's, you know, in full gear. And so it would make sense that we've got good fall beers, too, right?
I think so. The temperature works out pretty good. It's sort of like the one roughly 6 week period where like the temperature really works in our favor to have just a beautiful setting, you know, whereas it balances out the fact that it gets so hot here in the summer and so unbelievably cold for the other like 6 months of the year. So yeah, so it goes, but you drove the Crosstrek.
I did.
Gave it a really good review, I think. Nicely done, of course, but you also gave it a very positive review.
I did,
so,
yeah.
Kind of break us down, like, your thoughts on the Crosstrek.
Well, okay, so I'll preface this all by saying last fall season up in not quite the Upper Peninsula, the upper part of the mainland in Michigan, we went up there, Traverse City, Petoskey area, and did a subcompact crossover comparison test.
Right, and right about this time.
Yeah, and in that test, that we had the Honda HR-V, the Jeep Renegade, the Hyundai Kona, and the Kia Soul, and they finish in that order with the Soul on top. And at the time, a lot of us opined that the Subaru Crosstrek would have performed really well in that test. We weren't able to get one, and they had some model year changeovers that were happening. So it didn't work out in our testing at that time. And we even mentioned in the write-up of that comparison that, you know, not every solid entry was in there, and the Crosstrek was like the main piece of the puzzle that potentially was missing. We've always liked the Crosstrek. Every time I went back and looked at our reviews of the Crosstrek, going all the way back to its, well, I don't remember, was it 2012, something like that, when it first was released? 2012, 2013, something like that.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah, like it really kind of invented the segment when you think about it. There have been small crossovers in the past, but if you look at what's out there now, things like the CHR, the Toyota CHR, the Honda HR-V, like those are the Nissan Kicks. They're basically little hatchbacks with a bit more ground clearance and like crossovery styling. So, you know, they sit up a little bit higher. They're made to look a little bit more rugged, and not every entry offers all-wheel drive. Not every entry has like a good amount of power or anything like that, but they all kind of follow the basic pattern that was set out by the Crosstrek. And, you know, at the time, I remember thinking, like, is this really what people want? Like, do they really want these little, small, not very fast, not super utilitarian vehicles? Well, the answer has been a resounding yes. This is what people want. And since that, like, 2012, the segment has just, like, blown up. Everybody offers one. Like, even luxury brands are offering them. Look at things like the Lexus UX, and we're going to talk a little bit about, like, you know, the BMW X1, X2, Mini Countryman a little bit later. They're all relatively similar sized. They're basically small cars. But they've got enough utility because of the hatchback. They've got a little bit more ground clearance, a little bit higher of a seating position, and it's apparently exactly what people want because they sell like crazy. And the Crosstrek has always been one of the better options. And that's especially true since, and I think it was 2017, maybe for the 2018 model year, and you guys have access to the internet, so you can look this up to check me on it. But that was when Subaru switched over to their new platform, which is excellent. It's way more solid than the old platform that the Impreza Crosstrek WX had been based on. The styling is good. The technology is good. The interior feels high quality. The ride, the handling, everything about it has been really good, minus one thing. It's underpowered. The Crosstrek has felt underpowered since the start, which is not abnormal for, you know, the small crossover segment. But they finally gave it what it needed, a bigger engine. They went from the 2-liter, which I think had 152 horsepower, to a 2.5 liter with exactly 30 more. It's 182 horsepower, I believe. And I mean, I don't want to oversell it. It hasn't transformed the Crosstrek. It hasn't turned it into a sporty vehicle. But it has rectified the one thing that everyone who drives it would notice, and that it's underpowered. And that, like, low power engine is exacerbated by the CVT transmission, which a lot of enthusiasts don't like anyway. But especially when you pair it with an engine that's got to be wrung out to make any reasonable power, those things just, they don't mix well. A continuously variable transmission and an engine that's got to be rung for power, it ends up just turning into a droning nightmare. It's constantly spinning at high RPM, and like you feel like you've constantly got to put your foot in it to get anywhere. And that's not just like you're trying to stop like Grand Prix or anything. That's just like, you know, merging onto the expressway or, you know, hitting the gas to get up, you know, so you can change lanes or something like that. The 2.5 liter engine is really, like, in my opinion, it's a must have for the Crosstrek. If you're shopping in that segment, you know, and I'm not one to tell people, you know, extend your loan out, but if it comes down to the Crosstrek is what you want, you can't afford the payments on the 2 liter, on the 2.5 liter, if that couple thousand dollars is the difference. I mean, talk with the financing guy and see if you can add a couple months to the loan, 6 months or something like that, because it really is worth it. It makes the car from, you know, I talked with James Rizuk about this. He's driven them before, and he's got some friends with them. It transforms it from a must drive, which is what he said. Like, it's a must test if you're shopping in that segment. But now it's not just a must test. It's like you're probably going to strongly consider bringing this thing home if you're shopping in the segment. It's really, really a game changer for the Crosstrek.
That's interesting. I think so. If you are in the market, sometimes I think on like first drives, we, you know, get these cars to review. Sometimes it can be a little tough to sort of break down what exactly like the real most important element of the new element of the vehicle is. But here mm-hmm. it's pretty spotlight. It's the engine.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you can still get the 2 liter. In fact, you still have to get the 2 liter if you get the base model or the premium, which is why like I'm kind of harping on like the MSRP, the sticker price. It is more expensive. You have to step up to a sport or a limited model to get the bigger engine. But I mean, it's worth it. It really, really makes a big difference to just the overall livability of the car. Now, I'll also say that you can get a 6-speed manual with the 2-liter engine in the base model. And that's a different ballgame. With the manual transmission, it gives you control over what the engine does. I'm not going to say it's any quicker than the CVT. It probably isn't. But the gas mileage is significantly worse with the manual because, you know, continuously variable transmissions can have a really low final drive ratio. So it helps them with the fuel mileage. With the 6-speed and the 2-liter engine, it doesn't feel peppy, but it's a fun little car. And something about having a manual transmission, you don't mind wringing it out quite so much because you're not forced to. You don't have to always do it. The CVT and that underpowered engine makes the Crosstrek drone and it makes it feel super underpowered, which was one of our big complaints with the Honda HR-V. Greg, you were out for that comparison test. And you probably remember, like, anytime you're trying to get anywhere in the HR-V, it's like, you constantly feel like you're, you know, not flooring it, but you're really hitting the gas hard and you're really working the engine and it ends up sounding messy and thrashy.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the HR-V in particular was an example of a vehicle that just needed a little bit more. It felt a little too bare bones to me. That vehicle, I thought, was like, it sort of walked the line of, I don't say walked the line, it was underpowered.
Yeah.
And you know, just the interior wasn't too good, and I believe it finished at or near the bottom of that comparison. So
yeah, it was in last place. Yeah. And Honda could do the exact same thing that Subaru just did. It's not like Honda doesn't have a range of engines that it could drop into the HR-V to rectify that underpowered, problem that it has. And that's, you know, to Subaru's credit, that's exactly what they did. And as much as all of us would love to see him drop a turbocharged WRX engine in the Crosstrek, like we all want to see a Crosstrek RX, or whatever you want to call it, Crosstrek XT. But you know, that's not what that's not what the masses are clamoring for. What they really wanted was just, you know, take the edge off that underpowered power plant, and that's what Subaru did.
Very nice, very nice. So this was actually the first press trip that you've gone on, really any of us have gone on, as far as staffers, in the like coronavirus era.
Yeah.
You know, it just, full disclosure, it took us a while to kind of make sure it was like a reasonable thing to do and, you know, get like approvals and all that stuff. But I'm just curious, how was it?
Well, I'll say that I was prepared to walk away when I got there. Like if I got there and it felt like they're not taking this seriously, you know, that would, you know, I was prepared for it to be messy. And to Subaru's credit, it wasn't. They did an excellent job. They had, they did it all outdoors. First press trip I've ever done in my home state of Ohio, for what it's worth. But they rented an entire property in rural Ohio. They built a big tent and, you know, they did everything outdoors in the tent. They brought their own tables that they could sit two people at on opposite ends. Required that everyone wore masks. They had hand sanitizer at every, you know, every table, every time you'd go anywhere, one person to a car. And you know, they took all the necessary precautions. I never once felt uncomfortable on that trip. And that was the big concern, is that, you know, like you feel like you got to do something because it's your job. But you also feel like you've got to take care of yourself and your family. And thankfully it wasn't an issue at all on this trip. Also, one cool thing that they did is at dinner, if you ordered a glass of wine, they had gotten these half bottles of wine so that they weren't like passing them around all the time. You order a glass of wine, they'd pour it for you, and then they'd leave that little half bottle there and they'd say, okay, that's your bottle. So like that just kind of shows you the detail that they went to make sure that everyone was comfortable and they weren't concerned about, you know, not properly socially distancing. So yeah, they did a good job.
Somebody call Anthony Fauci. If you give me half a bottle of wine, I'm going to be a lot more comfortable in a lot of situations. So that sounds pretty good.
Well, now you don't have to drink the whole half bottle of wine. You don't have to drink it, but they're just not going to give it to anybody else.
There you go. That sounds great. We'll put that up on, you know, CDC website, everything.
But no wine sharing. If you open a bottle, it's yours.
The funny thing is that actually happened to be in Europe, but this was like 5 years ago, way before this. They just gave everybody, it wasn't like a half a bottle. It was something like they opened the bottle and then, you know, we were passing it around, you know, everybody was topping off their glass. And then somehow I just ended up with like the wine. I thought this is like really good, like French wine. And I just kind of took it back to my, you know, hotel room and finished it off just because the bottle landed at my plate and it was my place setting and it was like an outdoor thing. And I was like, yeah, I have to do some work. Got to do some writing. And, you know, I mean, granted, it was like one more glass at that point, but hey.
Well, I applaud you, Greg. You didn't want it to go to waste. Yeah, I mean, what are you supposed to do? Pour it out? That would be alcohol abuse, right?
Well, I tell you what, it was on Bastille Day and we were in, I feel like this was a trip that was in Strasbourg. So it was, you know, it was pretty fun, good time. Cool. All right. So that's the cross trek. Let's move along. While we're staying in the crossover, crossover segment, if you will, the BMW X1, X2, and the Mini Countryman. These are three vehicles that are essentially on the same platform, and they are on the same platform. And I know you've been through all three of these, and to me, it's like, I sort of feel like the X2 or maybe the Mini are the way to go. The X1 is, to me, the most sanitized one that just, I think it's the most boring. It tries to be like an X3 or an X5. It doesn't quite pull it off. It's like you're wearing a shirt that shrunk and you're still trying to wear it because you like it, but you know, it's not the thing. So
no, that's a good description. That kind of is the case with the X1, isn't it? It's trying to be like the X3 and X5, which are wildly successful. Sales wise, the X1, you know, it's a front wheel drive vehicle. And that's kind of like, I don't know, like the antithesis of what BMW stands for, right?
Right.
They're historically, you know, the ultimate driving machine, which, you know, have you ever noticed that they don't call themselves that anymore? Because, you know, I think part of it is because it's not that, that kind of thrust, that driving message, isn't all that applicable these days. I mean, it is, but if they want to continue growing their brand, they have to branch out and, you know, kind of be all things to everyone, or at least offer all things to everyone. And, you know, they, to their credit, they still do everything with M badges, big, you know, crazy turbocharged V8 engines. And, you know, they, I'll put it this way. They still make the M5 for their, you know, for their enthusiast, buyers, but they also make things like the X1. And it's like we said, it's on a front wheel drive platform, which means the dynamics are just not the same. It's sanitized. It is a little bit boring. But it's because it's kind of sanitized and a little bit boring, it also probably is the right option for the buyer that wants the BMW badge, but also wants fuel efficiency, room in the back, a good ride, you know, those kinds of things that people want out of their cars. They quietly want out of their cars. Like, it's not the number one selling feature. But, you know, like the daily livability of it, is really good. And it wears that BMW badge, and that's enough for a lot of buyers. And it's the most popular one. They sell more of those than they do of the other models. And, you know, complain as we may, as enthusiasts who want BMW to continue being an enthusiast brand, they've got to sell cars to stay in business. So that's what the X1 is. And that's not to say it's a bad car. It's just not a great BMW. But they've got the X2, which is much more compromised, sits lower to the ground, which makes you wonder why it's a crossover SUV at all. Really, it's a hot hatchback when you really, you know, break it down. But it's got this crazy turbocharged 2-liter engine with just a ton of power. It's over 300 horsepower of a 2-liter turbocharged engine. They don't offer that in the X1 because that's kind of the mainstream model. They offer it in the X2, and they also offer it in the Countryman with the John Cooper Works package. So if you are an enthusiast and you're looking for performance, you're probably not looking at the X1, you're looking at the X2 or the Countryman. Between those, the Countryman actually offers more space, more usability, better visibility, and you get all the performance of the X2 M35i, is that what it is? X2 M35i?
Sounds about right.
Yeah. You get all the performance out of the X2 with a little bit greater daily driving comfort out of the Countryman. So, you know, if I were, and it's cheaper, the Countryman is less expensive with that big, powerful engine. So, you know, if I'm telling somebody which version they want and they're an enthusiast buyer, I'm probably telling them Countryman. Specifically the John Cooper Works, if you can stretch your budget there. But even the Cooper S is still pretty good with the turbocharged engine. If you want a daily driver, either look at the standard Countryman, or if you can swing at the S or the X1. If really all you care about is style and you want the coolest looking version, maybe the X2 is for you.
So I will go with the right brain or left brain, I mix whatever side is which, the logical one. And I think I would probably end up with the X1 just because I think it's the best at being a small crossover, like an actual small crossover. You can definitely debate the merits of how like BMW worthy it is, which it's not super, to be honest. But just from a looks perspective, the X2 is, I think, my favorite of the group. I actually had one about a year ago now, as I think about it. And I was able to get a car seat in there, and it was very tough. I had to really wedge it in. It's not a particularly practical vehicle. It says something when there's a Mini in the discussion, and the Mini is more practical than you are.
Right.
You know something's up there. But I mean, it's hard not to really just enjoy that kind of like that lowered sleek look. It's it's cool. And yeah, I'll say this. You mentioned how like people, you know, to go back to the Crosstrek, people wondered, hey, like, do people want this kind of a segment? And it turns out not only do they want that, but to me, these like small crossovers are like the natural successors to the small cars that we thought everyone was going to shift to in like 2005, 2006, you know, during just, you know, fuel issues and then the economy collapsed. Like there was a thought at that time that we weren't going to drive SUVs anymore. We were just going to drive small cars because everything was going to be so, so awful that we couldn't afford to fill up our Navigators and, you know, Expeditions. So the thought was the Chevy Cruze, like the Ford, the Fiesta, the Focus, those are the kind of cars that were going to like sort of save the world or the United States anyway. And then that was it. But I mean, immediately to your point, when the Crosstrek sort of emerged, it was like, okay, this small segment can be credible. And I think what you're seeing now is the luxury makers are, you know, I think they finally established critical mass there, and actually they're doing a better job of getting their identity into these sort of smaller, you know, vehicles. I think Mercedes is doing a little bit better of a job than BMW is. But I think that's also because Mercedes is, image has always been luxury, and you could put luxury in a lot of shapes and sizes. BMW has not always been luxury. They've been the ultimate driving machine, as you point out, which is great, and certainly they've always been premium, but it's like, well, okay, you know, your ethos aren't necessarily the fancy dashboard or the wood paneling or the wheels. It's that your car handles and steers and brakes better than the other guys.
Right.
So I think that's, in some ways, that's a tougher hill to climb. And that's why I think this segment with the BMWs, we really get, you know, kind of hot and bothered over it, if you will, and, you know, fuss over it.
Yeah. Well, I think anytime an automaker, like, adopts branding where it is, quote unquote, the ultimate of something, they're setting them up, they're setting themselves up to be... For future disappointment when they're no longer the ultimate of whatever it was that they were striving for. And I think that's also an issue with Cadillac. And I mean, how do you like that segue into the CT5 discussion? Like, BMW was the ultimate driving machine. Cadillac, for the long time, was the standard of the world, right? Like, and we still... No one forgets that branding message when it's successful, as it was for BMW and Cadillac. They, you know, they're setting themselves up as on this pedestal, BMW being the ultimate driving machine, Cadillac being the standard of the world. Well, now that BMWs aren't necessarily the most fun vehicles to drive, they don't call themselves the ultimate driving machine anymore. You know, they're still maybe the fastest, like, if you actually strap yourself into an M3 or M4 or M5 or whatever the top M badge is, those cars are just ridiculously fast. Faster than they even sound like they're going to be on paper. I lapped the Portimão racetrack in Portugal in the M5 on that last launch. And I mean, it's like we've hit insane speed. And to get them to go that fast, they actually have to dial some of the driving enjoyment out of it, because, you know, you take all the nannies off and you give someone ultimate control over the vehicle, unless they're Mario Andretti, they're not going to get the performance potential out of the vehicle that the computers can get. So they add the computers, the driving aids, they make the car ultimately faster, but less interesting and less entertaining to drive. Cadillac was the standard of the world. Okay, so in, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, You know, you could argue after World War II, back, you know, into the 50s, into the 1960s, they really were a standard bearing brand because, you know, it was cost is no object. What can we do to make this the most opulent, the most, you know, far out looking, the most desirable vehicle out there? And they were able to hit that and capitalize on the market. Well, that just doesn't fly anymore. In the world of Rolls-Royce and Bentley and, you know, some of those other brands, they just, you know, an American car company owned by General Motors can't go after that, can't realistically, profitably go after that same buyer. And so they have to become much more mainstream, and they lose some of that cachet that they had when they were the standard of the world. And that brings me to the CT5. I happen to be one of those people who really loved the last CTS, especially in its high performance trims. It was unique. It stood out. It had that crisp, cool, kind of chromed out styling. It didn't look like anything else. And, you know, to me, it was better for it. But it never sold in the kind of numbers that Cadillac needed to be super profitable and take on the likes of Audi, BMW, and Mercedes-Benz. For the exact same buyer. They just weren't gathering market share the way that they needed to. And so they come out with the CT5, which is, you know, more mainstreamed. It is less out there styling-wise. You know, they're not currently going for the, you know, super crazy performance, even though that kind of thing is coming. You know, they had to make it more desirable to a larger swath of people in order to make this a successful product for them. And so we get the CT5, which, you know, is a really nice car. It drives really well. GM's Alpha platform is epically good. It's super stiff. Everything they build on it, especially in the current Alpha 2 iteration, is just, I mean, the chassis is so good. That, you know, like, it becomes clear General Motors has the engineering know-how to do whatever they want to do, and do it really well. I like the engine. I wish it was a little bit, you know, more powerful for the version that I had was the V, the CT5 V. I wish that it had the V Sport, the CTS V Sports engine, which was what, 420 horsepower, something like that.
Yep.
Yeah, I wish that they had just carried that engine over in the V, you know, the mid-tier V, because in reality, the engine you're getting out of the CT5 V is the same engine in the CT5 Premium, what is it, Premium Plus, whatever it is that they call it, the next rung down, the more luxury-oriented version. It's basically the exact same engine. There's a tiny bit of tuning difference that gives it, like, I don't know, 10 more horsepower at the very high end of the rev range. So yeah, I mean, I like the CT5 quite a bit. It's not at all what I would call, like, the standard of the world. It's probably not even the standard in its own segment, but that doesn't mean it's not good. It's good, it's credible. I enjoy driving it. Doesn't put a foot wrong. I know James had a big complaint about the driving, like the ergonomic, not the ergonomics, but the, you know, the seat dash steering and pedal arrangement. Did he talk about that in the podcast?
Yeah. I mean, James is also a rather tall individual, although yeah, I guess so yeah. Are you actually. You're over 6 foot. So, I mean, it's...
Yeah, I'm an inch and a half shorter than James, I think. But, you know, proportions. He might have longer legs.
It's true. Yeah.
Bigger feet, something. I don't know.
There you go. There you go. Well, this is not where I thought the Cadillac discussion would go. comparing everybody's feet. I do think it's interesting where Cadillac is right now. I like the new lineup of the CT4 and the CT5. I think they made a mistake by not fully explaining out where, like, how the new V series is going to be, like, sort of doled out. I think that could have headed off some of the consternation that people, especially enthusiasts, have felt. I think it makes a lot of sense to put V on other vehicles
Agreed.
Crossovers. Mercedes and BMW are doing it successfully.
And Audi.
Yeah. I mean, Audi, though, I think you could argue AMG and M, maybe even V, are more than like Audi as far as how they could get, like, you know, their different like sport things, particularly the RS and things like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. I mean, like, we did talk about this last week. I think the looks of the CT5 and CT4 are pretty good. I think they managed to capture this like sporty yet elegant look that's interesting. And that's a way that I think Cadillac has been when it's been successful. I'm realizing I have a 1953 Cadillac on my little workstation down here.
Oh, pretty cool.
Yeah, actually, for some reason, I have the Hangouts blur on, so you can only see
it. I can see it when you hold it vertically now, yeah.
There you go. But this isn't as like crazy as, say, like the 59 Cadillac with those fins.
Right.
And then, you know, this is more just like an earlier, slightly rounder version of like what we then saw 10 years later in the 60s, like the 62, 63, those Coupe de Villes. Even into the 70s, I thought the Cadillacs looked pretty good, but they sort of morphed into like land yachts. And then in the 90s, they got boring, which I think
totally lost the plot.
Big problem. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. State of Cadillac, we could go off and on it for a while. I think they have a lot of the ingredients, let me put it that way. They just need to put it all together, and they need to like market and try to win in a few segments. And I think the Escalade, they're going to probably do very well there. Because, I mean, the large SUV has never been a problem for them since they've had the Escalade. So,
right. And I think they're doing cool things with the Escalade, like that, you know, it sounds insignificant, but that curved OLED dash is a thing of beauty when you see it in person. The way that the colors pop, it's like you walk into your Best Buy and you see the LED TVs, and then there's the OLED, and you're like, holy crap, that is gorgeous. That's the same thing in the Cadillac Escalade. I have some issues with Cadillac, and they're in a transitionary period, but like, the problem is when was Cadillac not in a transitionary period? Like, for as long as we've been...
Like 1977 or something, you know? I mean...
Yeah, like, they're always... Like, they're going for the next wave of Cadillac, and they've never really perfected what they were currently trying to be before moving on to the next thing. And that's kind of my knock with the CT5 is... And a lot of people are not going to agree with this. Which is totally fine. But when I park the CT5 next to the previous gen CTS, I'd take the CTS. It's more interesting. It stands out. And, you know, it's different. And I think Cadillac needs to be different. I don't think it's realistic to think that they are going to compete with Audi, BMW, and Mercedes-Benz on equal footing without having something really interesting to show, to draw people's attention. And something like the CTS with its like crazy sharp angles did that, at least for me. And my big complaint about the CT5V is it's just not enough. Like, it needs more V. Like, it's the diet V, and maybe it'll be enough for some people, but I don't think anything should have a V badge on it if they want to maintain like the relevancy of the V. I don't think it should have a V badge on it if it's basically a warmed over version of the lower spec model. And that's basically what the current CT5V is. After driving it for a week, my opinion didn't really change from the first drive I did. It is good. The ride and handling is great. It's missing that little special something that I feel like Cadillac really has to have if they want to conquest the European buyer, the European brand buyer. And I think maybe if it would have had the 420 horse engine at a similar price point, that might have been the thing that kind of set it apart. Because it like on paper, it does compete with the Audi S, the BMW, you know, lower lower spec M and the lower spec AMGs. It like, it lines up power wise, weight wise, it's a little bit less expensive. But I think it needs to not just line up, it actually has to offer something better to attract buyers and, you know, get them to shop Cadillac instead of going to one of the European brands.
And to your point too, and not only does it have to compete, you know, you're talking about brands that are really good, and mm-hmm. Cadillac has to beat them and give consumers a reason to shift. And I'm not sure these cars do, unless you're already a Cadillac buyer who maybe wants this size car and this type of engine. And that's just like sort of like your flavor of brandy, if you will. The tricky part comes in too, in the fact that there are no Black Wings out there yet.
Right.
They had this like holistic end-to-end, while I'm spouting cliches here, approach, it would all make sense. You would be like, okay, now as it is, if you're a V buyer, you're like, wait, my V sedan has this much horsepower? What the hell, man? So it's like, I don't know. I think a lot of stuff got a little bit lost in translation here. And it when you're Cadillac right now, you need to try to clear this stuff up. I will say this too. Cadillac isn't a great underdog. When they were like the standard of the world, which they were for like, I don't know what, 50 years. Yeah. And then, you know, they definitely maintained that aura well past that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's what Cadillac knows how to be. Like, I don't think they're good at being the scrappy underdog, you know? So, you know, I think that's tricky, you know, when you're trying to come up with a car and like, oh, we're going to take down the Germans. Well, okay, that's good. Mm-hmm. But like, you're also Cadillac, you know, like, so I don't know.
They need to like embrace their Cadillac-ness. You know, like the Escalade is a huge money drawer for them. And, you know, like if you're a religious Autoblog podcast listener, you've heard me say this before. There's no reason that Cadillac shouldn't have three Escalades in their showrooms. Yeah. A small one, a medium, and a big one. Because people buy them and they like them. Like, you know, that would bring them the cash, the influx of money and capital that they need for development that would make them, like, make things like the CT5 and the CT5V, they could afford to put a little bit of edge on those instead of like having those be their, you know, mainstream cash cows in making money by volume. They could make a ton of money per vehicle on like a line of Escalades. And I don't know why they don't do it. Like, but whatever, I digress.
Well, the playbook is there with Lincoln. You know, they've got the Navigator, they've got the Aviator, and these are like rough and tough SUVs. And then they fill it out with like the Nautilus and, you know, several other vehicles. Cadillac, I think, has done a pretty poor job of filling in the gaps with everything but the Escalade. You know, the XT6, people are like, well, wait, what's that? You know, and it just, I don't know. I mean, I think Cadillac has a lot of good, like I said, good ingredients, individual good vehicles, good cars, things that are compelling on their own, but it's, you know, it's tough. And it, like I said, it's tough when you've got the standard of the world in your history, you know, people expect you to win. People don't expect you to be like, well, we're good in this segment and we're working on this one, you know?
Right.
That's
right.
Tough. Right. You know, I mean.
So. And I think it'll be interesting to see how they transition into an electric heavy brand, because that's what the plan is, right? Like, they're going to be GM's flagship electric marquee. And you know, when we talk about like, we're in a transitionary period right now, that's what we're talking about. Like, they're transitioning, like, this is what they're offering right now. They're going to be the flagship electrified brand once that comes to fruition. We're not there yet. Like, we're filling in, we're plugging gaps, and we're doing all the stuff that we need to do to maintain relevancy as that transformation happens.
Speaking of electric cars is perhaps the new performance segment, or a performance segment, a different kind of performance segment. The Lucid Air and the Tesla Model S Plaid, love the name, both turned very impressive times at different tracks. You know, definitely check out these stories. We have them on site. They went up mid to late September, you can easily find them, Google them. But I mean, the broader theme here is like, These are fast cars. You get instantaneous torque. Usually you get a very quiet experience. And they're coming from non-traditional brands. Like in this conversation, Tesla is the, like, you know, the establishment. And then Lucid is almost the newcomer. So, I mean, my just general thought is that this is a good thing. I've been, I mean, since the start of this, you know, over 10 years ago, when electrification was being used in a manner that was not for fuel economy, it was for to get more power, been a huge supporter of it. You see it done in Formula One and other racing series. I think it aids development, and I think it makes for a more direct technology transfer from racing programs to the street, and I think that's a good thing.
Right.
You know, these two cars look pretty fast, to put it simply.
Yeah. I mean, I'm honestly blown away by the performance of these, like, recent crop of, or coming soon, electric vehicles. And let's be clear, Lucid is not a production vehicle right now. They're not an automaker that you can march out and go buy.
Right. Right.
I feel like they're like well on their way. Like, I don't think they're vaporware. Like, I'm not suggesting that. But, you know, we're talking about these things, and, you know, you've got to add that in there that you can actually go out and buy a brand new Tesla right now. And that's not true of Lucid. I don't think that that detracts from the achievement that a 9.245 second quarter mile at 157 miles per hour, like, that is crazy fast. And it speaks to the potential of the electrification of the automobile. I wrote that story on Autoblog, and I was doing a little bit of research to kind of round out the story. And I mean, we're talking hypercar performance out of a basically, you know, family sedan. I mean, it's not exactly, but 9.245 seconds is faster than the Dodge Demon, which is a car that, like, when it came out, it was heralded as, like, OMG, this is the muscle car to end all muscle cars. You know, they pulled out all the stops, drag slicks on the back, tiny little, you know, skinny wheels up front, an air conditioning compressor that feeds cool air to the already supercharged intercooled engine. Like, they did absolutely, they stripped the interior out. They did absolutely everything that they could, and they got a 9.65 quarter mile. Barely repeatable. Like, 9.65 on a perfectly prepared track on the absolute most perfect of all days with the best driver. In reality, you know, like, your typical person, you know, Joe or Jeremy or Greg off the street is going to hop into a Demon and be happy to turn something in the low tens. Because it's not easy. Like, you got to walk the car off the line, you got to feather it, you got to get on the gas just at the right time, or else you're going to burn the tires loose, you know? These Teslas and this Lucid that they're currently testing, and it's headed for production, it's almost like a gas and go kind of thing. Like, you know, I mean, as much as we love shifting gears, every drag racer who's actually racing for money has gone with an automatic transmission for as long as I can remember. You know, power glides were the big thing, you know, in the 60s. That was how to get repeatable performance. Like, the four-speed, four on the floor is what sold in showrooms. The people wanted that on the street. But, you know, when you're actually out there setting fast times drag racing, people use the power glides. People still use automatic transmissions to set their best, most repeatable times now. There's no shifting gears in these electric vehicles, even if they have multi-gear transmissions. Some, you know, a few do, but it's just not a concern. It's line up, hit the gas, let the electronics do their thing, and it takes off. And no one is like, you know, to touch on BMW again, no one is calling these things the ultimate driving machines. That's not the point. They are just stinking fast at a drag strip. Like, they get up and go. Like, you wouldn't even believe, like, those stories you probably heard, you know, growing up, if you were in the muscle car scene, of, you know, someone would tape a $100 bill to the dash and, you know, take off and say, if you can reach it, you can have it. That's the kind of acceleration we're talking about out of these cars. Like, pin you back in your seat, whiplash, you better be wearing a helmet kind of acceleration.
It's interesting because you know, when you look at specifically Tesla events, they don't just talk about, Elon Musk doesn't just talk about the environmental benefits. He really talks about the performance. And I think that's an interesting, like, sort of touchstone for, you know, electric vehicles in general, is the just this sheer, you know, speed, velocity is baked into the cars, right, on many of them anyway. And, you know, it's like, you might think, like, the typical Tesla buyer maybe wants it because, well, you know, you're saving the world, or you, you know, you're trying, you want an electric car. But that's a hallmark. It's a pillar of their marketing. And I think that's brilliant, to be honest. I think that really, yeah, is like, you're not just getting a green car. You're getting a fast car. You're getting, you know, at least something that's aspiring to be the best car. You know, I mean, right, fit and finish, all sorts of things we can talk about, you know, different quality issues with some of the, like, newer car makers. But not even for this discussion. Like, if you get a Model S, it's fast as all heck, you know? Mm-hmm. And
right,
that to me is a brilliant selling point. And I think it's cool that Elon Musk have really steered into that. I mean, you know,
yeah,
I mean, I could go out and talk on this forever, and we'll briefly touch on this a little bit here in a minute. But I, you know, think it's a good idea in many ways, if you can, to consider embracing, like, an electric vehicle in your life, you know, mm-hmm, whether it's a mm-hmm hybrid or a full electric, you know, if you're into that, if you think, you know, that this could definitely solve some of the issues we're facing as a world. But Tesla, and then, as you mentioned, in these two timed runs, these cars are amazingly fast, and, like, you're not mm-hmm compromising. These are faster than, like, most of the Cadillac V's, the AMGs. I mean, what is it?
They're faster than all of them. They're faster than all, like, when you're talking, like, actual lap yeah times and elapsed times, they're faster than everything. I mean, they're faster than demons.
Yeah, 1.9 like, seconds for the Plaid. That's unbelievable. You know, that's like,
yeah,
like rocket ship speeds, you know, like.
And not just in a straight line either.
Sure.
The yeah the Plaid prototype has set a Laguna Seca lap record.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's what I think too is it speaks to, and again, I'll give more credit to Tesla, that they thought, hey, let's get this thing to Laguna Seca. Let's get right somebody who could drive the car and set a time. You know, this is, I mean, these aren't like, you know, I don't know, the stereotypical people who are like, you know, like the Prius buyer, if you will, who wants like right a slow appliance. That's generally speaking, that like is meant to be like draw it out, you know, but mm-hmm I mean, these are performance luxury machines. So I think that's, mm-hmm, that's a really cool part of the green industry right now. And I mean, that's what gets me as excited as an enthusiast and as, mm-hmm, you know, green car, you know, also enthusiast at times, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel similarly. You know, we both grew up in, you know, in a part of the country that is, you know, kind of hinges on the success of vehicles. And we both grew up with a, you know, kind of passion for speed and muscle cars. Like, you know, we were always at the Woodward Cruise even before we covered it. And that makes me excited. Like, we're not just in the golden age of performance right now because of muscle cars and Challengers and muscle cars and Camaros and BMW M's and AMGs. We're in the golden age of performance because electricity's like starting to become established too. And that's why, you know, that's why Ford slapped a Mustang badge on the Mach-E. It's not just an efficient car, it's also going to be a fast one. And speaking of efficiency, when I was doing some research for some of these stories, sometimes it's easy to forget how efficient these cars are. They're super stupid fast, but what they do with the amount of energy available to them is incredible. We're talking about the size of battery packs, and the biggest battery packs there are you know, in production vehicles are pushing what, like 100 kilowatt hours, maybe not quite there yet, but close. That's like 3 gallons of gasoline, like energy, like total, like strict limit of how much energy can be stored in that. They're getting hundreds of miles and setting these performance records with the energy equivalents of, you know, three, four maybe gallons of gasoline. That's incredible. Credit where credit's due. Like automakers like Tesla, we give them grief for Musk spouting off his mouth when he should like stay off Twitter. We give them grief for maybe not screwing their cars together as well as they should. But absolute kudos to them for upping the efficiency and performance game and kind of setting a standard for other automakers to reach for.
Well said. Well said. We'll close out the news segment and the podcast here with just a real quick lightning round on California's ambitious goals of basically by 2035, new car sales will need to be zero emission. So I'll just kind of kick it back to you. Do you think this is going to happen?
No.
Okay.
not without caveats. I think, you know, the laws are probably going to be massaged. They're going to be altered and changed. There's probably going to be waivers and there's, you know, are they going to hit? Are we looking by 2035 that every new vehicle sold is going to be electric? I doubt it. And I say that as someone recognizing that those kinds of like moonshot things wouldn't be necessary if buyers would actually embrace what they need to do now. You know, more new energy, you know, electric vehicles and hybrids are sold in California than anywhere else. But still, people are out there buying hugely inefficient vehicles because they like them. And you know, this is America, you can still do that. But that's why we have these moonshot things that by 2035, we need to be completely emissions free to hit climate goals. If we all would embrace the, you know, the efficient side of things for our daily driven transportation, these kinds of crazy, like crazy sounding on the surface, like proclamations like this one wouldn't even be necessary. However, they are necessary. Climate change is real. The emissions issue is real. It has to be done. And 2035 in reality is probably too late to you know, hit the targets that we actually, that science says we need to hit. Do I think it's going to happen? Probably not. Do I think it needs to happen? Absolutely.
Wow. I like the nuanced position there. You really nuanced, but very well reinforced. My take is it probably won't happen. I also think, but goals like this are necessary. I think I think it's good for government to be optimistic, if you will. I won't get political, but I think there's nothing wrong with having, you know, a stretch goal like that. You know, Kennedy said, let's go to the moon. This is not all that different. To go back to some numbers, though, California is 11% of all new car sales, according to Reuters. And it's the world's fifth largest economy. So if this does happen, holy cow, man, a lot of changes are going to be ahead.
Yeah, one thing I'll tag team on this discussion, and I'm looking at the clock and realizing we're getting close to an hour. So I don't want to like, you know, harp on this too much, but something that isn't widely reported on in Newsom's statement that was going to happen is that's actually going to include off-highway vehicles as well. So dirt bikes, as you know them, two-stroke, four-stroke, what have you, banned, gone. ATVs, snowmobiles, side-by-sides, those are all included in this zero emissions pledge. So, you know, like, this is a big deal. This is like a major shift in thinking. And if nothing else, it could potentially scare people that are on the fence when it comes to, you know, what their next new vehicle should be. Maybe it'll scare them into embracing the middle steps that will actually, you know, by and large, make a difference leading up to 2035. You know, if people start looking at the smaller, more efficient engine option, if they start looking for, I don't need a, you know, Dooley F350. All I really need is the F150 with the smaller turbocharged six cylinder. You know, like those are the kinds of changes that will, you know, if adopted en masse, could make a difference. You know, leading up to this 2035 end goal.
I think car makers are preparing for things like this. Cadillac has said that they planned to be substantially like electric vehicles by 2030, I want to say. I mean, that's a pretty ambitious play. You know, granted, right now they're more of a niche brand, but still, that's pretty ambitious. So, I mean, I think car companies expect more stuff like this to be coming. It's tricky when it comes to just like, you need a small crossover or a small sedan. It's got like a four-cylinder engine in it. It's 20 to 25 grand. I think that's where you're going to run into some practical implications. You know, like, right. What do you tell, you know, XYZ person who just needs like a relatively cheap new car to commute in that they have to drive an electric vehicle? And it's tough to put it all on the car maker to try to make that affordable, you know? I think there'll be, to your point, some tweaks though. Like, there'll be credits involved. There'll be like, I feel like there's going to be a way, ways this gets nuanced.
Right. So. It'll be interesting. You know, so many people would be driving things like the Chevy Volt, which is no longer, sadly. So many people would be driving things like the Chevy Volt and the Toyota Prius Prime if they really looked at what they need. And looked at it with like even the slightest I care about the environment bent, they would have bought things like that instead of, you know, 3 Series and A4s and C classes. Like, a Volt was more expensive than a Cruise, but it also got great gas mileage and like 90% of your driving was gonna be done on electricity. And if those kinds of prospects would have taken off, like a lot of us were hoping that they would when they were introduced, you know, like I said earlier, these kinds of moonshots for electrification, maybe they wouldn't have come out quite so quickly, even though, you know, in the end, I think electricity is going to win over internal combustion, you know, wholesale. But yeah, we're in a very, very interesting time covering the automotive industry right now.
Good place to leave it. That's all the time we have this week on the Autoblog podcast. Be safe out there, whether you're driving a V8 muscle car or an all-electric electric vehicle. I hope you enjoy the drive, and we'll see you next week. Take care, everybody.